Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome back to As It Is, the program that helps you learn and improve your American English. At the same time, we talk about world events that may affect you, your country, or your friends. Today, we turn to China, where some Muslims are being told they cannot participate fully in Ramadan, the holy time they celebrate once a year. We will tell you why. Then, something that makes our lives much easier is doing great harm to the world's oceans. Stay with us to find out what it is and what we can do to make things better. As It is coming to you from Washington. Now, on to part one. Some local governments and organizations have published notices in China's Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. They are barring students and government workers from taking part in traditional fasting during the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. Some China experts say the ban on fasting is not new, but it could fuel tensions in Xinjiang. Christopher Cruz has more on the story.
Muslims around the world, including Uyghurs in Xinjiang, are observing Ramadan. During the month, they are not supposed to eat between sunrise and sunset. But many in Xinjiang have been told they must eat during the day. They include government workers, teachers, and students. June Tuffel Dreyer teaches political science at Miami University. She says Chinese officials often say they are enforcing the ban on fasting for health reasons.
I am aware that it is actually nothing new. They have prohibited this before during Ramadan. And it is always presented as a health issue, that you shouldn't deprive yourself of food. Students need to keep their energy up to study, and civil servants need to keep their energy up to do their jobs properly, and so on.
Professor Tuffel Dreyer says the ban has become a sensitive issue, partly because of the recent violence in Xinjiang. Reza Hazmath is with Oxford University in England. He has published several books about China's ethnic minorities. He says the ban will worsen problems in Xinjiang.
There is heightened tensions in Xinjiang among the Uyghurs, particularly given the flash ethnic violence that's been occurring in the last year and a bit. And so this just reinforces more antagonism, if anything.
Alim Saitoff is the president of the Uyghur American Association. He was born in Xinjiang. He believes the ban will worsen tensions. He says it violates China's statements that it does not restrict the beliefs of ethnic and religious minorities.
In fact, it means China does not have any preferential policy. It actually opposes Uyghurs, religious beliefs. It is an anti-religion policy. So many Uyghurs, including myself, dislike this policy very much.
There has been conflict between Uyghurs and China's majority Han Chinese for many years, but it has worsened recently. In May, two cars that many believed were driven by Uyghurs drove through a crowded market in Urumqi. People in the cars threw explosives at the crowd. At least 39 people died, and more than 100 were injured. I'm Christopher Cruz.
A new report says plastics are responsible for $13 billion in damage to the oceans and the undersea environment. The findings were announced recently at a United Nations conference in Nairobi, Kenya. The report tells about harm to sea life and what might be done to improve the situation. Plastic thrown away carelessly makes its way into rivers and other waterways. The plastic eventually reaches coastal areas and ocean waters. After a while, it collects in the sea, and plastic never goes away. Nancy Wallace heads the Marine Debris Program at NOAA, America's National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She says plastic is not biodegradable, destroyed by bacteria or natural processes. Instead, it just breaks up into smaller pieces over time. Nancy Wallace says the oceans contain a lot of chemicals and other pollutants. She notes that chemicals like DDT are now illegal. But she says the remains of such products may find their way to plastics floating in seawater. Then fish may eat the plastics. That means harmful material may get into our food supply. But the NOAA expert says people can make a big difference. She suggests using fewer single-use product containers and throwing plastics away correctly. She also likes plastic recycling programs, where old bottles and other plastics are collected, broken down, and used to make new products. Nancy Wallace says people should really care about the environment. She says human beings cause pollution, and they can take steps to stop it. Richard Matteson leads TrueCost, the company that presented a report at the UN Environment Assembly in Nairobi. He says the findings suggest another way, a business plan that opens new markets for plastic products that last. Mr. Matteson spoke to VOA on Skype.
You could reduce the energy intensity of plastics production by using renewable energy sources. You could reuse bottles in our households many, many times over if we wish to, rather than just bin it after a first use. We could, when we get rid of that plastic, recycle it and reuse it, which replaces the need for virgin raw materials.
Andrew Russell directs the Plastics Disclosure Project, which released another report at the UN conference. He calls on companies to improve methods for using plastics. The report asks for them to better measure and direct plastic use. And he said it calls for information about the way plastic is thrown out or removed from use. Mr. Russell spoke to VOA over Skype. He said industry could save money.
We also see them to be much more aware, much more cognizant of risks they face in the environment from a reputation perspective or from a regulatory perspective. And if they think about plastics the same way they do other things, then I think these opportunities will present themselves.
Mr. Russell says that by putting a new value on plastic, industry has a special reason to clean up the environment. But he also says all of society must join to deal with the problem. Many of you write to us and ask about things here in the United States. Well, not everything is so serious in the States. Probably just like you, we like to have a lot of fun. For instance, up in Laverne, Minnesota, they are having the 52nd annual Hot Dog Night, and officials are giving away thousands of the delicious treats. You may know them as Franks, Frankfurters, or hot dogs, but they are a favorite food nearly everywhere in the United States. People in Gearing, Nebraska are celebrating Oregon Trail Days. It's a time to remember the pioneers who first traveled west into what would become part of the United States. In Nebraska, they are dancing in the streets, having lots of good food and music, and buying handmade art. And up in Wolf Point, Montana, there is a wild horse stampede or race. People are also looking at items made by Native Americans, and learning how they lived before our country became the United States. And for us, the As It Is team, another workday is done. Thank you for spending some time with us today. Promise to come back tomorrow and we'll be here. Learning English is a part of the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. A group of U.S. educators recently criticized American university partnerships with Chinese government teaching programs. The Chinese institutes and Chinese classrooms operate in the U.S. and nearly worldwide. They teach Chinese culture and language. The American Association of University Professors says it has concerns about the integrity, the honesty and fairness of these relationships. The Canadian Association of University Teachers already had expressed such concerns. The AAUP says the Chinese state agency Hanban directs the institutes and classrooms. It says a Politburo member and the vice premier of the People's Republic of China direct that agency. The AAUP criticizes most agreements between Hanban and the schools. It says they have made what it calls unacceptable concessions to the political aims and practices of the government of China. The Chinese People's Daily says 440 Confucius Institutes and 646 Confucius classrooms operate in 120 countries and areas. The newspaper says 70 are in the world's top 200 universities. Henry Reichman of the AAUP told VOA that the association's concerns are not directed at China. Instead, he said, they are directed at the universities that negotiated the agreements for the programs. He said, if North American media reports are true, the programs often may compromise the freedom of their teachers under terms that are not made public. In his words, we would prefer that American universities, if necessary, renegotiate their agreements with Hanban to make sure that these institutes conform to American academic freedom processes. Noted that the Chinese programs provide teachers from China. He said American universities usually have the right to refuse to hire any of these teachers. But he said evidence seems to show that right, in his words, has been used rarely, if ever. He said the teachers then are governed by the rules of Chinese universities instead of American universities. Mr. Reichman said, the teachers appear to lack the freedom to discuss issues. The AAUP has called on universities to cut ties with Hanban unless the agreements are rewritten. The organization wants U.S. schools to have total control over teachers and teaching materials. The association also demands that the Confucius Institute teachers have the same freedoms as other university teachers. The People's Daily has denounced the AAUP position. And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report. I'm Jerry Watson. Thank you.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The most difficult national problem facing the administration of President Franklin Pierce was the situation in Kansas. The territory struggled with the issue of slavery. Pro-slavery settlers elected a representative to Congress. Then, they won a majority of seats in the territorial legislature. An investigation found that people from the neighboring state of Missouri had voted in the elections illegally, yet the results were accepted. The new Kansas lawmakers did not like the territorial governor. They demanded that President Pierce dismiss him. Pierce agreed. This week on our series, Ray Freeman and Steve Ember continue the story of the presidency of Franklin Pierce, and they talk about the presidential election of 1856.
Anti-slavery settlers in Kansas felt they could not get fair treatment from either the president or the new governor. So they took an extreme step. They formed their own government in opposition to the elected government of the territory. Their political group was known as the Free State Party. Party members wrote their own constitution and chose their own governor.
President Pierce said the actions of the Free State Party seemed revolutionary. He warned against violence. He said if party members attacked any officials or property of the territory or the federal government, party leaders should be charged with treason. The president gave the pro-slavery governor of Kansas control of troops at two army bases in the territory. Many people feared that the governor would use the troops to arrest the leaders of the Free State government.
Fighting between the two sides almost began when a Free State man was killed by a pro-slavery man. Free State settlers gathered in the town of Lawrence and organized a defense force. At the same time, hundreds of pro-slavery men crossed the border from Missouri. They planned to go to Lawrence and burn it to the ground. The pro-slavery governor and the Free State governor agreed to hold an emergency meeting. They negotiated a settlement, and the men on both sides went home. The truce did not last long.
In the weeks that followed, a number of attempts were made to stop or arrest the leaders of the Free State government. Pro-slavery officials urged private citizens to help. Once again, hundreds of men, including many from Missouri, gathered in Kansas. Once again, their target was the town of Lawrence. This time, however, there was no truce. The pro-slavery mob attacked and burned several buildings. A number of people were killed. The violence might have ended quickly, but one of the men defending the town believed that the battle against the forces of slavery must continue. And he believed that God had chosen him to lead it. The man was John Brown.
John Brown heard that five Free State men had died in the attack on Lawrence. So he said five pro-slavery men must die in return. He led a group that seized and killed five people. The civil disorder in Kansas continued. Settlers were forced off their land. Houses were burned. More people were killed. The territory became known as Bleeding Kansas.
It was clear that there were deep differences between the northern and southern American states. The differences involved their economies, their systems of labor, and their way of life. The civil disorder caused by these differences was the chief issue in the presidential election of 1856. Three political parties offered candidates: the Democrats, the Republicans, and the Know-Nothings. The Whig Party did not offer a candidate. The party had gone out of existence by then. Its members had split over the question of slavery in the Western territories. The split could not be healed. Many Southern Whigs joined the Democratic Party. Most Northern Whigs joined the Know-Nothing Party.
The Know-Nothing Party began as a secret anti-immigrant organization. It feared that too many people from other countries were coming to live in the United States. Members did not want to admit that they belonged to the group. When asked, they said, "I know nothing." And that is how the organization got its name.
The Democratic Party was led by President Franklin Pierce. Pierce wanted to run for re-election. Many Northern Democrats, however, objected to his support of the pro-slavery legislature in Kansas. Other Democrats did not think he was the strongest candidate. As a result, Pierce faced competition for the party's nomination. One opponent was Senator Stephen Douglas of Illinois. Douglas had great political ability. He also had many political enemies. He was the man most responsible for gaining congressional approval of the bill that opened Kansas to slavery.
Pierce's other opponent for the Democratic nomination was James Buchanan of Pennsylvania. Buchanan was a Northerner who would probably leave the South alone. "I am not friendly to the idea of slavery," he said, "but the rights of the South, under our Constitution, should have as much protection as the rights of any other part of our Union."
The Democratic Party met in the city of Cincinnati, Ohio. It was the first time a national political convention was held that far west. Candidates needed 2/3 of the votes to win the nomination. After several days of voting, no candidate had received enough. So, in an effort to unite the party, Stephen Douglas offered to withdraw. James Buchanan got his votes and the nomination.
The Republican Party was a new political party. Its members opposed slavery for either moral or economic reasons. Many Republicans were abolitionists. They wanted to ban slavery everywhere in the United States. The majority of Republicans, however, were not abolitionists. They had no interest in ending slave labor in the South. They simply did not want slavery to spread to other areas. The Republican Party held its presidential nominating convention in Philadelphia. For months, party members had spoken of just one man. He was John Fremont. Fremont had explored the American West. He had been a senator from California. He was young and exciting. Republicans thought he was the right man to lead their young and exciting party.
The Know Nothing Party had a divided nominating convention. Northern and Southern members agreed on policies that denounced immigrants, but they split on the issue of slavery. Northern members opposed it. Southern members supported it. Delegates to the convention chose a candidate who seemed to support the party's policies. Yet he was not even a member of the party. He was a Whig, former President Millard Fillmore. Northern members refused to support Fillmore. They broke away from the Know Nothing Party and supported the Republican candidate, John Fremont.
Fremont could not expect to win any votes in the slave states of the South. He would have to get all of his support in the North. He would have to win the votes of the big states, including Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania was the home of the Democratic candidate, James Buchanan. Buchanan had said that the constitutional rights of the Southern states should be protected, so he could expect to win some votes there. When all the votes were counted, Buchanan was elected. Now he would have to deal with the problems that presidents before him had not been able to solve.
James Buchanan was 65 years old. He had served in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. He had served as Secretary of State and as ambassador. He was a good diplomat, but he was not considered a strong political leader. Buchanan usually supported the Southern position in the dispute about slavery. He said the North should stop interfering with the South. He even said the South had good reason to leave the Union if Northern abolitionists continued their anti-slavery campaign. As president, Buchanan believed he could solve the slavery question by keeping the abolitionists quiet. He wanted a cabinet that shared and supported this idea. We will tell about James Buchanan's administration in our next program.
Our program was written by Christine Johnson. The narrators were Ray Freeman and Steve Ember. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs can be found, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.